Yeah, talking about eufy.com. The Eufy video lock is unbelievable. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Best Buy stores starting on May 20th. What is it? It's a smart lock, 2K cam, and doorbell, 3-in-1, triple security, so you can have everything you need in one device rather than install many pieces on your front door. It's not just for security, but also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys like my wife. You can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated camera. It's easy to install and set up with just a Phillips head screwdriver, no drilling required. It's got a keyless entry. No more fumbling for the keys. When hands are full, never worry about kids losing keys or passing among the renters of your house. You got a rental property out there, this is a must-have. I love this product. Just got it a couple weeks ago. Huge fan. Have the Ring camera. It's okay. It's not as great as this, so I swapped it out. Go to Eufy Video Lock today on YouTube. That's EUFY Video Lock, or visit EUFYOfficial.com/video lock to see how you can gain complete control of your front door.
Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by StrikeForceEnergy.com. Put down the water and grab a fucking drink.
Hey, whoa, boy.
I have a feeling someone special is on the show today.
Yeah. Someone extra special.
Extra
possibly
special.
Possibly a prior president of the United States in the future.
Right. Come on. Is Dale Dye here?
Mr. Yeah. Dale Dye is with us.
It'd be President Mattis to you.
Yes. Yeah. Welcome. Welcome, Mr. Dye. I have seen you since hugging you, squeezing you into my chest, and telling you to get the fuck off the stage, I believe.
Not all you squeezed. And
I squeezed a lot.
Still upset about that. I told you, no tongue.
That was a big day we had together. That was a fun day.
It was great, Ross. Yeah, thanks.
That was one of our favorite moments on set. We talked about that for a long time. You're also in the new documentary, Not Another War Story, with us. It's an honor to have you, sir. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks, guys. I'm delighted to be able to say a few words to your audience, which is huge, and I appreciate it.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a crazy show, Dale. I don't know if you've listened to the 100th episode, but
don't.
It is a crazy, crazy show. Matt Best is ironically the most tame out of all of us, which. If that's saying something.
Be.
Yeah, exactly. That'll let you know.
I'm like the closet tame one. I behave myself here, you know, mistakes in private. That's the way I roll my life.
That's right.
You know? But not episode 100.
So
that
we're,
was,
yeah,
that
we're,
was,
we're also joined by Scott Levy.
Yes,
who is
we are.
Another friend. So you'll have, and Evan's here.
Yes, I am here.
Yes, there's Evan.
Look at that. We got a full house, Ross.
Full
we
house,
got a we are John Stamos away from a full house at this point.
three aces and a pair of deuces.
Exactly. I like it a lot. And
savage.
We have some sponsors here, Mr. Levy and Mr. Dye, but I really, before we get to the sponsors, Dale, I want to ask you about doing a TV show called Rough Riders and what it was about in 1997.
Very cool. That was a show directed by John Milius. We did it for TBS, and it had Sam Elliott, Tom Berenger, all the usual old Western cast. And it was great because with Milius aboard and directing, he wanted everything to be military precise. And so I had 2 weeks to actually live in the field as a cavalry unit.
Wow.
And we had all the horses, and every day we'd have boots and saddles and have to get up and groom the horses and saddle them up and practice all the formations, which promptly went in the crapper as soon as the cameras rolled. But but the important thing is we got that discipline. It was a great movie project. Tom Berenger was absolutely great as Teddy Roosevelt. I didn't suck completely as Leonard Wood. And Sam was his usual great mustache self, you know. I mean, he talks a lot like this, and yeah, he did kind of. you need to kind of know you're dealing with Sam Elliott.
I'm a huge Sam Elliott fan. Still got one good arm to hold you with.
Yeah.
The reason why I wanted to ask about Rough Riders in particular, because you have a long illustrious career, which we'll get to. Rough Riders in particular, though, John Milius is one of my personal heroes. And the fact that you got to work with him is a jealousy that I will never, ever be able to get over.
Let me tell you a story about working with John, though. He's a gun nut. A lot like...
Huge gun nut. Huge.
Everybody here at the table is a huge
Perfect.
Gun nut.
We get along.
So we get along. But John would disappear from the set. He's directing this, you know, and we would get ready to roll, and me and the first AD and everybody else would have everything all set up, horses in place, everything, and John's nowhere in sight. Where is John? And then you hear a couple of gunshots over the hill. John's over there playing with weapons. and typically, you know, we finally had to assign a second AD to him, assistant director. So he stayed with John, and immediately when we were ready to go, he took the weapon away from him and brought him back onto the set. So
that sounds a little bit like Ross Patterson when he went and stole the shotgun and just was dumping rounds out in the desert.
Yeah. The only guy with an auto shotgun in the entire zombie apocalypse.
Happens to be the director. You know?
You're welcome. You're welcome. Yeah, Milius pulled a gun on somebody on another set.
I don't know. I do know that much like many other people of my background, when the weapons start cranking, I'm sexually stimulated. And you know,
welcome to Drinking Bros.
Yeah, fits perfectly in.
You sort of pole vault across the grid square.
Right. That's the only way me and my lady get to completion is if I shoot an AR in the sky right before.
Tango, you know. Mike, India.
I like a little TMI. A little TMI for Dale. Okay.
Oh, no, that'll be the post show. Huge fan. This is going to be a great show. We got some sponsors who ironically pay for this to be on the air, Dale.
Weird.
First up is StrikeForceEnergy.com. What was your quote about it? What was your last quote about guns? It'll get you there.
Yeah, it'll get you there. Exactly.
It'll get you there.
Yeah, well, that's what Strike Force Energy does on the energy side of things. It'll get you there. Look, kids, you need to get them dicks up and you don't have a gun. This will do it. Go to StrikeForceEnergy.com. It's the tastiest, tiniest little pouch full of energy that goes in every single liquid available. It ships everywhere in the entire world. They have a subscription of the month club. And they get a 750 milliliter bottle that you can just boom, boom, squirt as you go. Pun intended.
And don't drink it all at once. I saw that guy make the video where he drank the whole Strike
It was actually
Force.
Wine, so he lied.
Yeah, oh,
it
was a prank.
It was a prank.
Oh, God.
I enjoyed it, though.
He would have died. His heart would have exploded.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
no.
Man.
It would have. It would have.
Well, go ahead, Russ.
Go to StrikeForceEnergy.com. Type in the promo code DRINKINBROS for 20% off. Next up, we got ghostbed.com. Is Dale sleeping on a ghost bed out there, Jared?
We should make sure.
Boy, that's a fine sleep, Dale.
Listen, these are commercials. I'm not going anywhere here.
Yeah.
This is how you make your money. I get it.
Yeah, ghost bed will look, it'll send you to the grave a little quicker. That's how comfortable that sleep is. It'll make you never want to get up. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. Once you're there, you get $50 off a bed. You get 3 free pillows with every bed purchase. And we're coming down to the last couple days here of show us your worst mattress. Take a video of your mattress, hashtag it fuck this bed, and then tag at ghostbed, and you'll get a free mattress. Classiest show on earth, Dale. Ghostbed.com
clearly
is all
no
your
doubt.
Sleeping needs. Again, promo code drinking bros. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. Next up, we got grenadesoap.com. Incoming right to your taint. They got a taint scrubber.
We need to work on your incoming, man.
Incoming!
Yeah, there you go. Jared's got it.
Way
I have a feeling no one's ever thrown a frag grenade at you. Incoming.
This isn't like mail in your inbox. Yeah. incoming mail.
Yeah, the 5-meter kill radius and the 15-meter wound radius.
Hey, guys, incoming. Let's check it out.
Hey, guys, incoming.
Oh, I should run and jump.
I've got a sleeping child on the other side of the house. Daddy screaming out war cries isn't gonna do much for his sleeping patterns.
His little siesta.
Yeah. Look, grenadesoap.com. The soap is what's the soap, Matt? Well, how would you best describe this soap?
You know, OD green and combat clean, bro. That's how I describe
it. Goddamn right you would. It's made with real gunpowder, so you smell like a real man. They've also got tactical toothbrushes,
so
dot kits.
Scrub off the crap.
Yeah. They got teen scrubbers over there. Go to grenadesoap.com. Type in the promo code Drinking Bros. You get 20% off. Next, we got warfightertobacco.com. The finest cigars and all the biz. We should give Dale some cigars on the way out, Jared.
Yes, we should. We should.
These cigars, smoke them if you got them. If you don't got them, go get them and smoke them. Look, they're for any occasion. If your lady gets knocked up, congratulations, here's a cigar. You've done something good in life.
I mean, maybe post-pregnancy, you think? I think that's fair.
Post-pregnancy.
And we can talk to the Surgeon General about that after the show.
Yeah, pre-pregnancy. Whatever. Whatever your fancy is. A couple puffs isn't going to kill the baby.
Pre-post.
yeah. Same goes for trannies. Pre or post-op. You're welcome to have one. Smoke up.
Take a puff. Just take a puff.
Just take a puff.
Yeah, Warfighter Tobacco is for trans.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, puff at any time.
It's cigars for trans.
It's cigars for any occasion. If you still got it on,
whole bunch
get it
to Chelsea
off.
Manning.
Yeah. rumor is Chelsea Manning got out and had a cigar 10 minutes afterwards. Go to warfightertobacco.com, type in the promo code Drinking Bros or DB10, and you get you get fucking 10% off. Rocco's a co-owner, and if you want to see him in your local tobacco stores, go in and grab the owner and shake him down or slap him across the face and say, put these
Nothing
fucking cigars in the
a
store.
Veteran made dog rocket.
Yeah,
that's right.
A dog rocket.
Dog rocket.
Stick that puppy in your face and go for broke.
Stick that puppy in your face and go for broke.
We
Words
should have
Dale
on
Mr.
full
Dale
time.
Dime.
We should have Dale on full fucking time. Last but not least is Black Rifle Coffee. Evan Hafer, why don't you tell us about it?
Wow, Black Rifle Coffee is a premium roast-to-order coffee. We roast it right here in Salt Lake City. And we roast the finest, freshest cup of coffee you can get in the land, and it goes right to your doorstep. So go grab yourself a Black Rifle Coffee membership. As a matter
tell
of fact,
back the one peg.
We're drinking, well, at least Dale is, and a few other people here.
I'm sucking it right Rifle in my pie hole right here.
Yeah.
That's right. So, yeah, we've even got the one bag membership. So you sign up for a membership, you get discounts through a combination of retailers throughout the industry to include Leupold as of next month. So sign up for
Leupold. We added about 10 more to the list today.
That's right.
Yep.
Fucking killing it, man, with that membership. That's the way to do it, which is I set it up. So when you make a good purchase like a Leupold Optic, you'll basically pay for your coffee for the year with that discount. So
and you'll hit your target.
That's right.
Yeah,
yeah, you will.
A fine American-made optic, man. So they're not paying us.
If you need optics, I mean, iron sights are good with me, but go ahead.
Typical Marine.
Once a Marine.
Typical Marine.
Yeah.
Them newfangled optics.
Yeah.
I don't need no glass.
Yeah.
Just show me the front sight blade. Get away from me. Sorry, I don't know where that came from.
Oh, I love it. Evan, promo code Drinking Bros for 20% off at Black
Rifle
Coffee.
Promo code Drinking or Drinking Bros, man. You can take 20% off. You can even take your percentage off your membership. So sign up, grab a membership, get it to your doorstep every month.
Perfect, perfect, perfect. Mr. Dale Dye. Man, you have had an unbelievable career. I'm looking at your IMDb right now. It says 84 credits. How many of those do you actually remember?
About two.
Yeah. You get into movies that high, it's got to be like, oh, man, there's got to be movies. If I name them off, you probably wouldn't remember, right?
I'm sure there would be, and some of them I intentionally don't remember.
Oh, so Range 15.
Range 15.
Range 15 is one.
No, listen, I've played everything from a Lance Corporal to the President of the United States.
That is pretty cool.
I'm POTUS.
Yeah, I like it.
Range 15.
You were a great POTUS. Seriously.
I hope so.
You sold it.
I got upstaged by this guy, Ross.
That guy.
My deal went right in a crapper, but...
That is a pretty cool thing. Everything from a Lance Corporal to the President of the United States. He has now held every rank.
Every rank. from rifleman, squad automatic weapon to president.
I got the whole deal.
Yeah. I mean, just breezing through your list here, like Naked Run. Do you remember doing that movie?
No.
Exactly.
No. That's what I'm talking about. Do you remember?
So many movies.
So?
You've done so many movies at this point that it's...
There's been some dogs out there.
Yeah, but...
You don't
have
to see one called Mayday Delta Force 4 or something, do you?
Mayday Delta Force 4.
That's awesome.
The only way they got me to do that was they were shooting in South Africa. And so they offered me a 5-day, all expenses paid safari to Zululand.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Yeah.
So I took it.
Right.
Yeah. And cashed the check.
But then you got to be in Mayday Delta Force 4.
Yeah.
I mean, so who really won?
I think of Navy SEALs and then Mayday Delta Force 4.
Yeah.
They promised me that it would never be shown in the United States.
Oh.
And then I got home, and 2 months later, there it was on cable. And everybody I had ever known called me or wrote to me on email and said, boy, what a butthole.
I kind of want to watch this now.
Please don't.
We gotta order this off of Amazon right now. I also see you worked with Oliver Stone twice. How was that?
Yeah, 5 times, actually.
Wow.
Oliver's a visionary filmmaker. He and I are obviously political opposites. Right. On sets, they usually call me John Wayne and him Ho Chi Minh. You can figure that out.
Yeah.
Look, he's a guy whose heart is in his place. It's not in my place, and I get that. But I like to work with him simply because he's such a terrific filmmaker. I mean, he knows the camera. He knows where the emotional beats are. He knows how to go after that stuff. Sometimes I think it's not the right stuff, but he gets it done. We haven't done much with each other in the last couple, 4 or 5 years.
Well,
but he's doing now,
right? Like
he's been over with Putin.
He's been doing these crusades. He interviewed Hugo Chavez, and then this documentary, this 4-hour documentary with Vladimir Putin is coming out.
Wow.
Yeah.
So his...
And then I'm going to do one. It's called Kill a Commie for Mommy.
We actually have a poster of that set.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
You know, it says drink coffee, kill commies.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. What was your favorite Oliver Stone movie to work with? Was it...
It had to be Platoon.
It had
to be Platoon. I mean, look, here's the thing about Platoon. At that point, we had $5 million all in.
Wow.
That's it.
That was your whole budget?
Yeah, that was the whole thing.
What year was that? 79?
85, 86.
Yeah.
So that's equivalent to what? A $25 million film this
year? But the key is, yeah, that's right. It is. But the key was that Oliver was the only guy in Hollywood that understood what I thought was wrong with war movies. And I'll take a minute to tell you that if it's all right.
Please. Yes, absolutely. No, yeah.
Look. There'd been technical advisors, so-called, and I'm making air quotes here. There'd been technical advisors for, you know, as long as there's been movies. And what I discovered when I came to Hollywood and started to research it was, frankly, these are, you know, some guy who was the director's brother-in-law who'd been 6 months in the California National Guard, and they put him in a chair and sat him there for $500 a week and only woke him up when they wanted to know which side the ribbons went on. I mean, it was so shallow. They didn't get how we relate to each other in combat in extremis. What our love means, as opposed to what romantic love means, and I said that's what's missing. No wonder actors can't portray who we are. They don't understand how we think, how we feel, what's in our guts and what's in our hearts and what's in our minds. So I went to Hollywood trying to sell that, and of course they said, "Hey, Bravo Sierra, elbow you out of here. Yeah. We don't need you. We've been making movies for years." And Oliver was the only guy that really understood what I was trying to say, what I was trying to do. And the reason was because he was a combat infantryman. He got it. And so he gave me 33 actors in 3 weeks. And at that point, they weren't anybody. There was Berenger and Charlie Sheen and Johnny Depp and Forrest Whitaker. Those names didn't mean anything in those days.
Sure.
And he let me take him into the mountains of the Philippines, Philippine jungle, for 3 weeks. And they lived like we lived. No foam rubber in the packs. The rucks were 65 pounds. Wow. And they dug their own holes and they lived in them. Even if they dug one right at the base of an anthill, which Charlie Sheen did, they lived in those holes. And me and my guys pulled switchblade on them at night, and they got maybe 2 hours of sleep. And we'd roll them out at 2 a.m. and run goats, mountain goats, through the position, the night defensive positions, and watch them burn up 250 rounds of M60 ammo. So we gave them the real experience. And 3 weeks later, when I brought them down out of the mountain, he looked at him and he said, yeah, that's you and me when we were 19.
Right.
And that just showed through their eyes and through their performance. And when we got that home, that little $5 million film, and that's all we had, not a dime more. So none of that Range 15 running over budget crapola.
Right.
We had $5 million, that's it, pal. And so when we won, you know, 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director, you know, Stone was gracious enough to credit me with a great deal of the verisimilitude in the picture. And from that point on, my point was made. Nothing succeeds like success in Hollywood. So it just, everybody wanted to have me do their war film for them.
Right.
And it grew up into, you know, the rest.
And let me ask you, out of that group you had, who was the best and who was the worst as far as terms of a soldier?
Berenger was terrific. He'd have made a good, solid corporal squad leader.
Wow.
Good guy. And he could live hard. He knew what that was about. Sheen wasn't bad. He didn't whine and bitch. He was a little bit of a pogey bait. He was always trying to smuggle candy and shit. Can I say shit? Sorry.
Yeah.
You can say whatever you want.
Are you kidding me, nope. Dale? Yeah, I've said fuck about 8 times already.
Okay. So he was pretty good. Willem Dafoe, interestingly enough, was good. Little Johnny Depp at the time was pretty fair. Huh. And we surrounded them with guys who weren't big name actors, but really wanted to do this and really wanted to understand it. And every night they would train all day, and there was only one down period, and that's what we call stand down. And we do stand down for an hour, and it's right around evening chow time. They only ate twice a day, and then it was all rations. So at stand down, they could ask any question they wanted to ask. They could ask actor stuff. You know, how does this feel? What's that like? And that's where I really went to work on their minds and on their emotions. And I told them about stuff like survivor guilt. And I told them, you know, it could have been me, and maybe should have been me, and that sort of thing. And that stuff just rocketed home to those kids. You could see their eyes open up. And they began to say, you know, well, how would I apply that to my character? And suddenly the world lit up. Suddenly, they weren't just going to repeat the last bad war movie they'd seen.
Right.
They began to try to understand who we were and what we were. And throughout the shooting of that, the questions were just amazing that they would come up with. And it was detailed little stuff that you and I don't think about because it's second nature to us.
Right.
Yeah. And they would ask these questions, and I would take the time to answer them to their satisfaction. The big thing for me was it started to bring me back from my own combat experiences, because I spent a lot of time at war, too much time, and for a long time I couldn't talk about some of it, or I didn't want to, and so I would resist it. But these kids drew it out of me, and I knew that if I was going to do the right thing, if I was going to teach them who we really are and what we're really about, I had to get into my own gut.
Right.
And into my own heart, and tell them some stuff I wasn't really comfortable with. But if I did it, they'd get it. And so it kind of drugged me along a path to getting back into human beingness.
Was that a pretty interesting experience for yourself?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I don't have to tell you guys this sort of thing, but when you get into some badass stuff, when you get into some tight stuff, and I did, you compartmentalize it, you put it away somewhere,
right?
And you rarely touch it. Yeah, you can joke about it, and we all do, and that's what keeps us sane, and so on and so forth. I get that, but that really gut stuff. That stuff that brings tears to your eyes, that stuff about seeing somebody die in your arms and or seeing somebody so chewed up you can't do anything for him, and those are the things we compartmentalize. Those are the things we put back here, and we don't – only occasionally when there's a lot of Lead Slinger whiskey around or it's another guy who's seen the elephant and heard the owl with you, then you can talk about that stuff. But even then, you get over it real quickly, and you try to make a joke out of it. And I think all of us who've been there do that. And when I began to have to explain it to young actors, something like that is so far out of their wheelhouse, you know, so far out of the average civilian's experience, that you really have to get in depth in order to have any chance of them understanding it. And so you find yourself talking about crap you just wouldn't normally. And I found that kind of, you know, brought me back along a little path so that I didn't hate every civilian,
you know,
and have a plan to kill them immediately.
This is so much more,
right,
though. Like,
that's so crazy.
When people think about tech advisors, I think they immediately think it's just, you know, making sure the uniforms are right and stuff like that. Not this.
Like, no. Yeah. No, I don't want to play that. You know, I don't want to play that.
Well, but the technicalities of war are somewhat they're not necessarily significant. They are, but they're, a lot of them are battle drills, which are ultimately your unconsciously competent reaction mode.
Muscle memory.
Yeah. So much more of war is quite literally emotion. It's fear. It's elation. It's fucking tragedy. It's so much more emotion so the technical proficiency or the fucking uniform, whether it's right, yes, you have to match the dirt and the grime, but the technical proficiency with the weapon is just part of it. So if you're trying to capture that, you know, that's exactly right. There's no fucking emotion prior to platoon, really.
Look,
right?
I'm sitting here with a bunch of combat veterans. Now, you tell me if I'm lying, I'm dying. The one thing about combat that's the common denominator that we all know is that in it you will see the full gamut of human emotion. Yeah. You'll see the worst thing human beings can do, and you'll see some of the most heroic, best things that human beings can do, and everything in the middle.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And that's just the nature of it when we get in extremis like that. Mm-hmm. But telling civilians that is pissing up a picket rope. I mean, they have. Sorry, was that a bad thing to say?
No, no, that's great.
It's fucking awesome.
Pissing up a picket rope. I don't even know what that is. This is great.
So they don't get it. Now you can say, all right, piss on you. I don't care whether you get it or not because you're the great unwashed, unfathomable, untouchable human being. You can, and I did that for about 10 years. Didn't want anything to do with civilians. Wouldn't marry one. You'd have to pay me to screw one. The point is that's why I married a woman Marine. But the point is the point I'm making is that if you're gonna do that, if you care about the nation understanding who we are as the nation's professional warriors, if I care about that, and I do, that's my agenda. Is just to shine a little long overdue light. Nice yawn, turd.
There's the captain.
Fucking Jared.
He's getting me.
JT over here with a big, big yawn. Sorry if I'm boring you.
No, I'm captivated right now.
Yeah.
Nice yawn, turd. Boy, awesome. that's gonna stick with Jared a lot. You've no idea how much I'm gonna say that. No.
It just like went to his fucking soul. Right? Yeah.
Now, how do you get back? Anyway, if I'm going to accomplish what I want to in my agenda, if I'm going to shine that long overdue light on us folks who wear the uniform and who do so voluntarily, then I've got to go there. I've got to get into those people's minds. I've got to appeal to them. I've got to find a way to explain to them something that is inexplicable.
Right.
If you haven't been there and done that. And that's the challenge. That's what I've been trying to do for the past 25 years or so. Sometimes I've done it fairly well, and sometimes I've fallen through my ass. But the point is, I still try. And that's what we're trying to do with this new film. How's that for a segue?
Wow.
Tell us about the new film, Dale.
What do you got out?
Yeah.
Boom. What? The new film? Oh. Thank you, Ross, for bringing that up.
You're acting like you've done this once or twice before. You know, it's fantastic.
Dude. I might have. The new film is a film, and I'm here with one of the co-producers, two of the co-producers, Tom Costa and Scott Levy, both veterans. It's a film called No Better Place to Die. It's a D-Day movie that we hope will do for the 82nd Airborne Division what Band of Brothers did for the 101st. The first 18 or 20 minutes of the film are all about the airborne assault, so we're hoping that it will do for the airborne phase of D-Day what Saving Private Ryan did for the ground assault or the surface beach assaults.
Is it a live-action movie or is it a documentary?
No. I'll leave the documentaries to somebody else. This is scripted material that I wrote.
Oh, great.
But it's from an actual incident at La Fiere, which is one of the two vital bridges over the Murderet River that the airborne had to hold. Had they not held that bridge and the causeway that ran off of it, the Germans would have blown right through and hit Utah Beach and hit Omaha and pushed the whole thing back into the sea. As Tom Costa likes to say, it was pivotal to D-Day. It may have saved D-Day. Mm. And I think there's some validity to that. It is a great story, and it's a story of paratroopers who were misdropped all over the Cotentin Peninsula and just came together, cobbled themselves together, and said, "We got a mission. Who's got a rifle? Who's got a grenade?" And went and did it. And they held it against German assaults, just constant artillery barrages and that sort of thing. So we decided to do this story. I had been studying this story from the time I was in uniform because it's a microcosmic example of the American soldier spirit. You know, the big plan went in the crapper. So we know the commander's intent. Let's go do that shit.
Do it. You
know,
yeah,
and off
awesome.
They went.
It's fucking awesome.
And that's the kind of spirit we want to show. Now, I had tried to sell this for a long time in Hollywood to the standard, you know, studio methodology and so on and so forth, not much luck for a couple of reasons, one of which is I insist on directing it because I know how to do this, and I know how to make it a blockbuster. So we didn't have much luck, and I fired the initial couple of producers, Tom Costa, who's a military academy guy and a former 82nd Airborne
Panther
guy.
Himself.
Yep.
Yeah, two Panther.
Jumped up and said, "Look, I want to produce this. Let me help you out." And we reached out to Scott Levy and a couple of other veterans, and they all said, "Veterans in showbiz." Which, by the way, is almost a misnomer. But we decided, all right, look, we're going to do this in a non-traditional fashion. Piss on Hollywood, piss on the normal method. We're going to just try to get this done. And while we're at it, we're going to do it as a military movie by veterans, for veterans, and made by veterans. Mm. So the commitment is to hire as many guys in front of the camera and behind the camera as we can who are actual veterans. What I'm hoping as sort of an ancillary benefit to this is that it will showcase the talent that's out there, that the young, talented men and women who write me hundreds of emails every week saying, "How do I get into showbiz? I want to be an actor. I want to be a cinematographer." It's a tough row to hoe. It's a bitch kitty because it's a closed shop. And they resist it, and Scott knows that. He's written several things that talk about, you know, Hollywood doesn't support our troops. Mm. So what we've said is, look, send us your money, whatever you can afford. Nickels and dimes are good. But we're gonna raise enough money to get rolling. We're going to raise enough money in this groundswell of public support to convince the deep pockets that we're onto something hot here, and the deep pockets will come in for the money that we need, and we'll get it done. Mm-hmm. So that's the plan. I am now stepping down off the soapbox.
No.
That's freaking amazing.
Continue. Have you shot anything yet, and where can folks go and help you out?
Yeah, please.
Mostly I've shot a lot of 45 ACP downrange just to sort of calm my nerves. We have shot some things, but we've not shot anything that we're ready to show anybody.
Okay. Is it on Indiegogo?
It's on Indiegogo, thank you.
How do people find that?
You just take your right Dick Skinner.
Okay, Dick Skinner.
And you whack that clicker thing, and you come up to Indiegogo, No Better Place to Die. You'll see it there. Okay. And
We also have a Facebook page, a YouTube page,
no
Twitter,
better
Instagram.
Place to
so no
die.
Better place to die?
No Better Place to Die. Okay. On Twitter, it's NBPTD Film.
Also, too, on Indiegogo, I was able just to search your name, and it came up. So.
Perfect. Yeah. Great.
So that's what we're doing, and the plan is, once we raise the money to cover all the administrative costs and the legal costs and yada yada yada, all the stuff you gotta do, what we're gonna do is take that money, which we and the buzz and the enthusiasm which we're getting, and that's a groundswell. That's something that we're seeing. I was discussing it with JT at lunch today. I mean, look, America out there. In so-called flyover country, more air quotes, they want their voice heard, and they want people to pay attention to them. If the recent election doesn't tell you that, I don't know what the hell does. So we want to capitalize on that groundswell. We want to be the black rifle of movie making. I mean, we want to say, look, we're making this film for you. We're making this because you want it, and because you need it, and because it's the right thing to do. And the amazing thing is we're seeing enormous response and support with this. I mean, people are saying, look, I can't send you any money. I'm broke. But I love this, and I'll dig ditches. I'll do anything you want me to do. I just want to be involved.
I will act in the movie, Dale. Okay. Well, yeah.
On that note, that's probably a good time to say that what you guys did was amazingly inspiring with Range 15. I mean, looking at that, you know, I didn't know you guys at all. You know, before meeting at the premiere and everything, and having wanted to have been a part of it after I saw it, going, oh, I wish it was so inspiring seeing what you guys did with Indiegogo, what you guys did with social media, with networking the vet community and putting that all together, and you know, putting vets to work, and what you guys do here, putting vets to work, is even more inspiring.
Yeah. So it's the same kind of thing, and Tom Costa just reminded me that I should mention here, and I will. That our plan is, if we can turn some profit out of this thing, we're going to give a percentage of it back to veterans' causes.
Absolutely. So.
Awesome.
That's great. Yeah.
Well,
I'm looking at the site right now. So far, you've a month left, and you've already raised almost $24,000, and your goal is $200,000. You've got 237 backers. Go to No Better Place to Die on Indiegogo and donate to the campaign. That's a good number, though, to start off with. That's a great number so far.
You know, the community got our comedy last year with Range 15. We need another World War II yeah. one, especially one yeah. that follows the paratrooper story.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll even throw in a zombie somewhere. I mean,
that's cool. Because to be honest with you, Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, I mean, movie and whatever you want to call it, a series. But those are my two favorite things to watch because they're so, you know, fairly historically accurate, and then just the emotional component through the guys serving together and all that ups and downs that you go through is literally almost the only war films that I watch.
And we got to get into it here because I don't want to hog it to just me and Evan.
Yeah.
Like, you got to tell them the story you're telling us about Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, yeah. And we got to start from the beginning.
Yes,
so
yes,
the, right. So the question okay. I was asking, I was like, hey, was this the first movie that was shot with this, you know, realistic, you know, the camera perspective, because I had gone to the movie with a guy that was a Vietnam vet, who's a former MACV SOG guy. He's like, that is the closest movies have ever come to actual combat. And so when we walked out, that statement has always stuck with me, you know, and of course, you know, going downrange, I'm like, yeah, that was about the first one that really emphasized the POV perspective.
Yeah, the
as
violence
well, right?
of it. Yeah. And,
That that was always Steven Spielberg's intent. He wanted to do what we all know as combat veterans is the rifleman's perspective, which is assholes and elbows. I mean, that's essentially what you see. Once the first one comes snapping by your ear, you're down, you know, and then you're looking what to do. And so Stephen wanted to do it from that perspective, and he had a lot of tricks in mind. He used 90-degree shutter angle, for instance, which gives you that choppy look, and you can see the dirt and clods and shrapnel flying in explosions. We had a bunch of little, really great beer barrel, low center of gravity cinematographer guys who were doing handheld, and they'd run right through those explosions. And so, you know, I kind of got my Eisenhower fix because it was my job to get everything happening on that beach. And we had about 1,000. We shot on at Kirklow Beach, which is in Southeast Ireland, County Wexford, and we had the beach prepped for weeks, you know, with the Belgian gates and the landing craft obstacles, and we had about 1,000 Irish, I guess they would equate to kind of National Guard troops, reservists. Mm-hmm. And we brought them in, and I put a couple of my NCOs on them, and like all good NCOs, they just trained the shit out of them. And taught them to do combat reloads with M1s and Thompson submachine guns and BARs and so on and so forth, because we knew that it was never going to stop. So we had 1,000 men on the beach, 14 armored vehicles, and 7 boats out at sea, and I had to control them all on one radio.
Oh, shit.
And, yeah, if any of you who've ever done that sort of thing. And so we got ready. Stephen had about 5 cameras ready to roll. And he looked at me and said, okay, we ready to go? And I said, well, just one thing, boss. I said, when we roll this puppy, don't bother to run around, wave your arms, and say cut, because it's going to go. I mean, there is just, you cannot stop this. It's like that, you know, when you go over the last 30 meters, nothing's going to stop it. There it goes. You know? And he knew that, and he said, "Well, okay, I guess, and off we went, you know." And it was magnificent. I mean, I was standing up on the bluff, trying to control everything, and my 2-3 NCOs down on the beach had earbuds in, and covered so they could hear me. And their primary job was to see that the tanks didn't run over anybody. You know, the tank driver's blind once all this crap starts flying, and so I just had them near the tanks. So they could throw anybody out that got tended to get run over by the tank, but it was just absolute magic once I saw it all go, and when it was finally over with, you know, when we had just reached the objective essentially, I mean, Stephen looked at me and went, shrugged his shoulders, and I went 2 thumbs up, you know. I mean, I knew we had it. It was just an amazing moment. When you know you've captured lightning in a bottle like that.
Right. That's amazing.
And he was so brilliant, Stephen was, to this, the business of when Tom Hanks' character goes underwater and all sound stops.
Yeah.
Well, you know that's exactly what happens.
Yeah.
And then as he comes back up, boom, the sound starts again. That was disorienting. And that was Stephen's idea. That's the kind of brilliant filmmaker he is. So we got that 18 minutes on film, and it was just absolute magic, and we saw it in dailies, and I said, whoa, you know, I mean, this is going to be dynamite. And when we got the film made, everybody appreciated it. We got beat at the Oscars by Shakespeare in Love, which almost made me piss myself.
Oh, my God.
But there you go. Thank you, Hollywood.
The worst.
And the amazing thing about it was we got this done, and the veteran community and everybody else just went nuts over it. They just loved that movie for a lot of reasons. But the main one was that landing sequence.
Yeah.
So when was the first time you got to see the cut? Did you see it prior to?
Yeah. I saw it in an assemble edit.
Okay.
But the only thing anybody bitched about was the captain's insignia on Tom Hanks' helmet.
Really?
And, you know, I had, yeah, and I had done all sorts of research, and it in World War II, it depended on your regimental commander. Some people wanted the officers to be identified immediately.
And then some didn't for
and
snipers.
Some didn't for sniper purposes.
Yeah.
So I thought we were absolutely fine. And then the attack of the stitch Nazis.
it's like an old school internet troll. I love it.
These are those Nazis. Guys out there, yeah, yeah, with the remote control in hand, and they stop it about every 10 seconds.
Oh, wow.
And then they write me directly.
Oh, God.
And say, you know, the color of the thread used in stitching the insignia on the left arm of
like
Soldier 3 was incorrect. It was brown and not green.
Yeah.
And you know, you just
reach in your pocket, nice sir, and go fuck yourself with me. Because go make your own movie and then tell me you did it right.
But, you know, in the end, I've got to be accessible to those people
because
they're fans and they pay their money and so on and so forth. It just can, of all the great stuff you do, if somebody's going to pick on you about the color of the buttons, well, I guess you pooped yourself.
I guess you did it right. If the only thing they have to complain about is the color of the thread.
I often thought.
You did it right.
Yeah. Did it right.
Yeah, I get it.
Like, that's the only thing they found.
What was it like working with Tom Cruise on Born on the 4th of July?
You know what? He gets a bad rap. Let me tell you, that guy has heart.
He was amazing.
He would have made a good trooper. Not necessarily a good officer, not necessarily a good sergeant, but a good trooper. He's got heart. I remember we were training him for Born on the 4th of July, and I had him and a couple of other actors you'd know, and I can't remember right now. I had them all in the field, and I said, typical Captain Dye stuff, I said, you're going to be out here with me for a week. You're going to dig your hole. Here's an entrenching tool. Dig it. And I'd mark the spot and, you know, make a perimeter, and they'd dig the hole. Cruz, I finally went up and looked what he was doing. He had the hole about waist deep, looked pretty good. But his hands were bleeding. I mean, just that E-tool tore his ass up. And I finally had to say, wait a minute, and wrapped his hands, you know. But he would not quit. He was going to get that hole dug. And then we had one of my training missions, right toward the end of the training schedule, when I sort of try to move the actors up into, if they're going to be officers or they're going to be NCOs, I try to move them up into that billet so they can start making decisions based on what I've taught them. And I moved Tom up into the squad leader position. And we were going to do this. You guys all done this 100 times. You're going to attack on a fortified position. So base of fire, maneuver element. And squad leader picks the direction of maneuver. You know, it's going to be hook right, hook left, or double envelopment if he's got enough people to do that sort of thing. And so we get ready to do this, and he had to cross a little blue line, which was our line of departure, and then go over into the assault. If I'm too far in the weeds, let me know.
Nope.
Look good to go.
But the first time they do it, he fell right through his ass. I mean, those guys were out there looking like, you know, a monkey fornicating a football. I mean, this was, it said, no, stop, get back, do it again. And they went through it about three times. Maneuver element just could not take advantage of the cover and concealment that was out there, you know. And I said, look, hook the other way, get into some damn trees, you know, to stop yourself from being seen, because they immediately turned the weapon on you. So finally, it was about the fourth time, and I decided, look, you're not going to get it today. We're going to go back to the chalkboard, back to the sand table. I'll explain it to you once again. If you can't see it at this point, And Cruz said, I know what's wrong, sir. I know what's wrong, sir. I know what we're doing wrong. Please, 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 let me do it one more time. And these guys were dragging ass. I mean, they were exhausted. And I said, you know, look, you'll be better at it tomorrow. He said, no, 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 sir. Please, please, let me do it. And bigger than hell, they did it the fifth time and got it perfect.
That's awesome.
But he would not let them quit. I mean, they wanted to quit, but he was the squad leader at the time.
Shower.
Yeah, right. Well, we don't have hot showers. I don't play that. that's for your foo-foo guys.
The theme.
I want a shower, please, and give me a jelly donut, and then I'll ship over, then I'll re-enlist. Okay. That's, sorry, I was just, I don't know where the hell I was.
It's fine. Oh, it's fine. Look, we love the randomness here on Drinking Bros. I'm gonna continue because you've had such an illustrious career. I want to get this all down, all the questions out today. Okay. You worked on JFK.
I did.
Evan believes that JFK was assassinated.
I already had this conversation with him.
By our own government.
Had the conversation.
But let's have
not
it on.
Not by our own government.
Let's
not
have
by
it on
our
air.
Own government. I'm saying that it's a definitive possibility that when you piss off half the clandestine service that has copious amounts of fucking money, along with a ton of experience of replacing government heads, you might be thinking about getting your head blown off. That might be a thing. You might go, hey, maybe I shouldn't be driving around in a convertible. I'm just telling you.
I don't know if that's a smart move, dude. Dale Dye, what is your theory on JFK?
If I had to point fingers, and not being a conspiracy theorist like Evan, if I had to point fingers, I'd probably point them at the old 2506 Brigade and the Mustache Petes who got trapped on the beach at the Bay of Pigs. Those guys were pissed off.
Still,
the CIA, the CIA, and the United States government whipped those guys like a tied-up goat.
Yeah.
I mean, the point is that, and they can be pretty vicious. Old Cubanos, okay. And you know, they do more than make cigars and rum. although I applaud all of that.
Yeah. I'm all about the cigar and rum.
But that's where I'd look. Yeah. I'd look at the Mustache Petes.
Okay. Is this because of inside knowledge or just a guess?
No. It's because of that good old speculation. You know?
Sure. Sure.
I'm comfortable with that sort of thing. Now that I'm old.
Yeah.
All right. Next question. What was your feeling when you first saw the movie Natural Born Killers that you were in?
I absolutely loved working on that film because it gave me a chance to cry on camera, which is, I really had to go for some baggage to get that done, but I managed to get some tears down.
First take or second take? Yeah, how many takes?
It was number one. I can't do it more than once. I've just got too many balls for that, but
he's got like 31 damn balls. Yeah.
31 balls to be exact.
You want to hear a story from Natural Born Killers?
Yes, of course. Absolutely. Of course.
We're filming this sequence in Winslow, Arizona, and it's a night sequence, and it's supposed to be a drug dream, peyote dream.
Yep.
And Woody Harrelson is carrying Juliette Lewis in their dream. She's been injured, and he has to take her somewhere. And we're shooting nights near the Grand Canyon, right outside of Winslow, Arizona. And Oliver wants rattlesnakes. They walk through a nest of rattlesnakes, Woody does, while he's carrying Juliette Lewis. So we ordered 250 rattlesnakes.
Holy
shit.
What's going to go wrong with that? And they ship them to us in big, flat, wooden boxes. Now, I don't know if you've ever smelled 250 snake shit things in a wooden box.
Can't say I have.
I was out there going, gas, 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 yeah. But at any rate, there we have them. And we put these rattlesnakes all around on the sand. Well, it's at night in the desert, which is cold, and the snakes promptly went to sleep. I mean, they're cold-blooded, and they just coiled up and said, I'm not having any part of this shit.
Right.
And so we're trying to – dawn is coming, and we got to get this shot. And the snakes are not cooperating. You know, Oliver wants them to get up and rattle and strike and make it look horrible, and snakes are having no part of this.
No.
So Oliver turns to his coordinator of violence and mayhem, Dale Dye, and he said, do something about the snakes. And I said, Oliver, they're cold-blooded animals. You know, they're asleep. And he said, well, we got it. So I went and got one of these snake sticks. You ever seen it? It looks like a shepherd's crook.
Yeah.
So it was a Steadicam shot. It was a low-mode Steadicam, and the cameraman is backing up, and Woody and Juliette Lewis are in front of him, and he's backing up with him. So I'm behind the Steadicam guy with my hand on his belt and this snake stick. And every time we pass a snake, I whack him right on the head, and he gets up. So I had to be the snake pisser-offer.
You're like, I'm not qualified for this job, but I'm going to do it anyways.
You talk about an MOS.
Yeah, right.
Snake pisser-offer. Yeah,
snake wrangler or pisser-offer.
I just like the fact that you can order up 250 rattlesnakes, gives me a totally different... That's a great practical joke.
From Texas.
Hello, friends.
Yeah. Hello, friends.
Wait, hey, here's a little package from Pottery Barn.
250 rattlesnakes.
Yeah, open that up and see what I mean.
Did the package come with like a certified snake wrangler? How the fuck just, you get them all back in the... Yeah.
Damn. We didn't.
The only other time many snakes were ordered was for the last Indiana Jones, or Indiana Jones 3.
Right. We ordered 250 snakes. We got about 40 of them back in the box. So, I mean, the rest of them are, who knows? They've all had little baby snakes out there in the Sonora somewhere. Yeah.
Like, man, there's been an influx of snakes around this area. I don't know what you're talking about.
We accidentally let 200 of those go.
Yeah.
What has to do with the formula and lead slinger?
Viper semen.
So we did talk about, like, we've talked a ton about your movie, your movie background, but I want to go back before, you know. So you're a Marine, and you enlisted in the Marine Corps. What year did you enlist in the Marine Corps?
January the 3rd of 1964.
Wow. Okay. And so did you go to Vietnam, like, literally right after it started?
No. I became an 81 mortar guy, mm-hmm. and went overseas, Okinawa, and then we went down and landed and did a little stuff very early on, but I was only there for a little while because I had already had some time overseas. My tour was up from my time on Okinawa.
Right.
Then I came back to the States and changed my MOS, and then I went back to Vietnam 67 and stayed 67, 68, 69, and 70.
Wow.
Holy Except crap. For medevacs.
And what was your MOS?
I was combat correspondent.
Okay. Wow. So you're there for, like, solid, so you'd go home on R&R?
There's some of that, right. and sometimes I'd get hit. Got the enemy marksmanship badge. Right. But in general...
Do you have
more
than one Purple Heart?
I have three, yeah.
Oh, wow. Fuck.
Wow.
This rides back from medevacs, that's what he was saying.
Yeah, no, I
was there the whole time, except for those medevacs.
So, I mean, the interesting thing was I was able to kind of run to the sound of the guns, which is what I felt obligated to do.
Right.
And in particular, during Tet 68, that got very weird. I was in Hue,
right.
Which is we were learning. You guys know all about MOUT now, you know, military operations in urban terrain. And back in those days, we called it FISH. Fighting in someone's house.
Is that real?
Yeah.
Fish? Oh, I
made that shit up.
That's fucking awesome.
That's awesome.
Fuck CQB, CQC, none of that.
Training fish.
Fighting in somebody's house.
I'm taking that. I love that.
Good. You can have it. We had all been trained to fight in the jungle, you know, and L-shaped ambush and, you know, how to stay off trails and look out for booby traps and mines and stuff like that. Then they dumped us right in the middle of this huge urban sprawl with on one side of the river was a kilometer square castle, essentially, and we were ordered to attack it, but they wouldn't hit it with any supporting arms.
Jesus Christ.
So it was climb the walls and kill the bad guys. You know? So we finally got over that because our regimental commander said, I ain't wasting any more Marines. You blow some holes in those walls, and then we'll go up and fix it, you know, and we did. But that was some of the tough times because we were learning as we were going, and we were – you saw – people just inventing stuff. I mean, just inventing ways to get things done. That was, I think that experience cemented in me the brilliance of Joe Shit the Ragman, you know, Rudy in the rear rank with a rusty rifle. I mean, don't underestimate this guy. He's got something in his sea bag.
Right.
And he'll pull it out and come up with something brilliant. And I saw instance after instance after instance of that in Hawaii. When guys were just, you know, we had to pull a gate open. But we didn't have breaching charges or any of that rock and roll stuff that you guys got now. So one of the kids got two bricks, tied a piece of rope onto the two bricks, ran out and threw the bricks over the gates, and then yanked the bastards open. I mean, it's brilliant. Nobody right. thinks of that, but he did. And we were hot wiring cars. I mean, we had young Lance Corporals and PFCs that flat knew how to hot wire a car.
You know? Right.
Yeah. Hey, Sergeant, I maybe hot wired a car once.
Maybe I did.
I mean,
hey, Gunny,
I'm not going to get
I
in trouble. You're like,
bastard.
God damn it, we're in Vietnam. We're going to get in trouble. Get it done.
Yeah.
You mean after that?
No. Whoa. No. Sorry about that.
Oh. So anyway, that was, yes, whoever that was, welcome aboard.
Welcome aboard.
Yeah. We saw that kind of thing, and I thought it was brilliant. I think that's what cemented my career at that point. I knew out there, despite the bad times, we had people wearing this country's uniform who would do anything. Oh, yeah, we piss and moan, but who doesn't? But they would, when the chips were down, when the crap got heavy, I mean, these are the guys that would walk up and find a way to do it. And I'm still seeing that. I'm still seeing it today. Troopers today are a bit more needy than they need to be. And I think if I ever see another FOB, I'll probably detonate it with a large charge of C4. But at any rate, we learned how to do these things. And I saw the greatness of America's youth. I saw the and America's senior guys who were over there trying to run it. I saw the greatness of it. Yeah, I saw all the crapple, and I saw the bad side of it. But what stuck with me was how brilliant they were at getting a job done without anything really to do it with.
Right. Well, that makes total sense.
And you stayed in the Marine Corps, I mean, well past 1970, right?
Yeah. I'm what they call a Mustang. Mm-hmm. I did 13 years as an enlisted man and NCO. And then when the Marine Corps decided Vietnam was over and we were going to clean up our act, and broom a lot of folks out who didn't need to be there in the first place. They looked around for guys who, you know, had a fairly impressive rack and were the kind of leaders that they were looking for. And they told me I was going to OCS, which by that time I was a master sergeant. And I said, what do I need this for? One more step and I'm a sergeant major and I'm in good shape, you know. And I had some really good officers talk to me and say, look, we need you to lead, and we need you to lead from this position, not the one below it. And so I didn't have a college degree at the time, and so they sent me to officer candidate school. In the Marine Corps, you go to officer candidate school and the basic school regardless. And so I went through and managed to graduate from both of those things, and I was appointed a warrant officer. And then later on in my career, I finished my college degree. And I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. And then was able to convert my commission. So I never was a second lieutenant. I went directly from chief warrant officer to first lieutenant.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Good. Never got the butter bar. That's
no,
good.
No,
that's
no.
Good.
Couldn't have stood it.
No.
With all those good conduct medals on
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
The interesting, I was stationed out on Okinawa, and I was going to the University of Maryland to try to get my degree.
Go Terrapins.
And... What's that?
Go Terrapins.
Go Terrap.
Yeah.
Terrapins.
Yeah, that's it.
Watch it.
Yeah.
I've got my eye on you.
The Fighting Turtles. The Fighting Turtles.
Yeah, the Fighting Turtles. Yeah, I'm impressed with that. But I needed to take my finals, and I was challenging a bunch of exams. You know, just not having taken the course, I was just going to try to pass the exam. And my proctor, my mentor at University of Maryland said, okay, you can do that. But you really need to study. You're going to need a week or 10 days where you're just doing nothing but cracking the books and studying and reading the text. And I said, okay, let me see what I can do. So I asked to see my battalion commander, who was one of these old guys, you know. He had a cigar in his mouth,
salty.
And he was sitting down there. He's a battalion commander. What I do is I break shit and kill people, you know. And so I had to go down and see him, and I said, sir, I need some basket leave. I need about 10 days off the books, and I need to really just sit down and study, and then I can get my degree, and I can push my career on, and so on and so forth. And they said, Ty, maybe I'll think about this, but what's your degree in? What are you studying? And I said, Colonel, my degree is in English literature. And he waited a minute, and you could see the blank look on his face, and he said, damn, Ty, what are you going to do, read him to death? But he was got to get out there and read their ass to death. Good, Ty, yeah, that'll wake, yeah, they'll bleed all over the place. You start reading them, man. So he gave me the time. And I was then able to pass the exams, and he granted my degree in English literature.
That's awesome.
So what year was that when you got your degree? And
that would have been 78.
Wow.
Somewhere around there.
So you still did six, 7 years after that?
Yeah. Then my next combat assignment was Beirut, Lebanon.
Okay.
82, 83. I went there as a captain. So.
Oh. When did you end up retiring out of?
July of 84.
84.
I retired. And I went to work for an outfit called Soldier of Fortune magazine.
Yep.
Maybe I did. But we were primarily in Central America.
Right.
Training and reporting a little bit. But mainly training counter-revolutionary forces. Mm-hmm. In Honduras, El Salvador, Costa Rica.
Cool.
Man, that's, you lived a crazy life. How long have you been married?
It's fucking cool.
Which time?
He's got an oak leaf cluster on that one.
Oh, boy. You talk about Purple Hearts. I've been married almost 16 years now. 17, I guess. No, wait a minute. It's coming up on 20. To the third.
that's a big gap. Off by 4 years.
It's somewhere in that area. to a great gal who's a PhD, and I have no idea what she's doing with me, but who cares? And so I think this one's going to take. God, I hope so. I've got enough trouble trying to get a movie made.
I can't imagine you on Tinder these days.
I do have to ask,
sure.
You know, who in the movie business, like, who do you absolutely love? Like, who's been the best boss director that you've had in the movie business?
Probably Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
But I have a dear spot in my heart, always will, for Steven Spielberg, who
right.
believed in me and gave me a shot to do it my way. I will always have a soft spot in my heart for Oliver Stone, politics aside, because he gave me the shot
right.
to prove what I was doing would work. So I guess those three are really top of the mark. I like Bob Zemeckis, John Frankenheimer, Billy Friedkin, there's a bunch of them.
So what separates Tom from Tom Hanks or Mr. Hanks, however you want to phrase it, but what separates him from everyone? Is he just
he's you and me.
Yeah.
And hasn't let Hollywood get to him.
Wow.
He's got a solid marriage. He's a solid guy from our part of the world.
Right.
And he's kind of a nerd in ways. He likes to see how things work. He's got that kind of inquisitive mind. You know, he's the kind of, if when he was a kid, you'd give him an alarm clock and he'd take it apart.
Right.
You know, never figure out how to get it back together. When we were doing Saving Private Ryan, he was armed with an M1 Thompson submachine gun. And I wanted him to know how to load it. The Thompson's a little finicky loading.
Yeah.
Because you have to go straight in with
straight
the mag.
In, yeah,
you can't rock
that
it.
Little,
yeah, you yeah. can't rock it. And so I wanted to teach him that, and I did, and he got very good at it. He could speed load that puppy in a hot second, and it fires from an open bolt, so he didn't have to worry about that. But the problem was I could see him looking at that Thompson, and I could see the little wheels turning behind his eyes, and I said, "Oh, don't take it apart. Don't, you know, it's got an H block and it's hard, and you know, and but he was going to have no part of it. I'm going to take this apart. I want to know the guts of it. You know, so I had to sit there for an hour on a poncho.
Fuck. Get the directions.
In the middle of piss and rain and give him a block of military instruction on the M1 Thompson. You know, he took it all apart. But he learns. I mean, he doesn't just, it's not superficial with him.
Right.
We did a land navigation course, and I didn't really want to teach him land nav. This is in the days before GPS, guys.
Right.
You know, when you had a lensetic compass.
Oh, you had what were they called, azimuth?
Yeah, that's what they called.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, I thought you might get it. But, you know, I was doing intersection and resection, so you could find yourself And I just said, I'm going to tell you some terms to use briefly so you can use them when you're map reading in the film. But we don't have time to go into this. And then the wheels started turning behind his eyes again. He absolutely couldn't get it that this would work unless we showed him. And so, and we were in this god-awful forest, you know, where you had to just fight your way through it. And I had to be his point man. And walk out on the azimuth, and he'd direct me right or left, so that I was precisely on the azimuth. And then he'd walk to me, and then we'd pick another point, and I'd walk up to it. And we did this for, like, hours. But the point was, when we finished, we came out within 10 meters exactly of where I told him we would be. And then he believed it. You know, so
that's awesome.
Sometimes you just have to do that.
Did you get a machete at least to pay
him? No,
pay him
I had to crawl through that crap.
Oh, fuck all
I
that
was
noise.
Eat up with ticks. I mean, they were...
That's crazy. These stories are priceless.
At least I ran point for him. You know, right. He didn't get the ticks. I got him.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, hey, this Dale, this has been easily like our best show we've ever had. You were an unbelievably fascinating man to talk to. You've lived an unbelievable life. Please go to Indiegogo for No Better Place to Die and donate to the campaign. This is also the point in the show, Dale, we get to the drinking bro of the week, which is somebody who's inspired you in your life. And we'll leave it to you this week to pick your point of inspiration. Is there anybody in your life, military or otherwise, who's inspired you in some way that you'd like to dedicate the drinking bro of the week to?
I've got a good buddy named Steve Burnson, who was with me in Hue and had been my partner all the way up to it. All the way up to the Tet Offensive. On the 14th of February of 1968, he pulled a wounded Marine down off of the wall in the Citadel in Hue. And he was hauling him down to get him to a truck that we could use to evacuate him out of there. They opened up with an RPG B-40, which is RPG-2, predecessor to the 7, and it hit the concrete right next to him, detonated, almost took off one leg and one arm, but he got that wounded man aboard the truck, and he's still alive today, thank God. But every time I see him hobbling on that cane with one arm that won't work at the elbow, and we just recently went back to Vietnam, he and I did, and visited the very spot in Hue.
Oh, wow.
And I will always think of him as a perfect example of, A, the greatness in the American spirit, the dedication and motivation of the American military man, and a really, really great drinking bro. With one exception, he likes warm gin with a pubic hair floating in it.
God damn it. That's fucking amazing.
God damn it.
Oh, cheers.
You were the best.
Cheers to that one.
Yeah.
You were the best guest we've ever had. Mr. Dale Dye, thank you for being on the show. Mr. Levy, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having us on. We really appreciate it.
And again, guys, No Better Place to Die. Check it out on Indiegogo. And if you can support the film, please do, because this is really awesome. And obviously from the interview, you can tell how much this all means to Dale and what where their heart and soul is. So check it
out.
You guys
are absolutely terrific. And the neat thing is it's like sitting around with a glass of Lead Slinger and talking to guys who get it. who understand it. I mean, I'm sitting here looking in Matt's eyes, and, you know, I can see him saying, yeah, I get it, I get it, I get it. And JT and Evan, and that's why you can talk about stuff like this, because you guys get it. So thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories. Absolutely amazing. You're welcome back anytime.
This is going to be the golden episode.
This has been incredible. For Mr. Evan Hafer, Matt Best, Jared Taylor, Ross Patterson, Mr. Levy, and the legendary Dale Dye. We're the Drinking Bros Podcast, and this is easily our best episode. Thank you for listening, everybody.